Hello and welcome to episode 249 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, Chris Weston and Gav Megnoth.
Welcome back everybody to WB40. We are here once again, Matt, facing, I guess, the cold and the winter that is about to descend upon the UK. How are things at your end, Matt? What's this week been like?
Getting chilly. It's been all right, kind of getting back into the whole work thing properly now. Been continuing to be able to try to close down on a piece of work with a new client, which hopefully will get resolved one way or another in the next day or so. Been taking a lot of coffee and tea as my 100 coffees project hits. Actually did my 10th one today, which is very exciting. And that's been great. And I have also, as people in the WB40 Signal group will well know now, taken receipt of an MEO digital saxophone, which is the happiest purchase that I have made of technology in many a year. It is a work of art, beauty, science, and the low-cost computing power of Arduinos, all in a beautifully enclosed saxophone-shaped box. So that's been keeping me entertained as well as I try to be able to relearn the instrument that I'd learnt nearly 35 years ago. So all good, really. How are you?
Well, I'm very well, really. Another interesting week has gone by. I mean, in terms of your gloating rather about tea and coffee, because I ran out of tea bags today, which was something of a disaster. And I realised that all I had in the house was a pretentious tea. So, you know, with citrus, you know, things and various flowery descriptions, which I had to drink. Because there wasn't anything else, but, you know, I don't mind a pretentious tea every now and again, but it was the only thing. I start to panic a bit. Thank goodness the office is open tomorrow. I can go and drink their tea instead. But, yeah, it's been a very busy week. Last week, I can't, honestly, where I was and what I did now, I cannot remember, because it's all going very quickly. But it's just, I think it's this first few weeks of the year, I've got a feeling that I really need to make the most of it, because it's going to kind of set a standard for how the rest of the year goes. Quite a lot of poking of anthills and things. So yeah, it's been good fun. And
very good.
And Matt, we have our guest this week, Gavin, who's here all the way from the United States. Gavin, how are you? And how's your week been?
Hello, gents. Yes, lovely to be here. And firstly, can I be the first to give you an early congratulations on what is a looming milestone of 250. Episodes. That's not shoddy at all. That's very impressive. And yes, as you said, I'm based here in Santa Monica, California. And a personal thank you from me, really. I'm obviously 8 hours behind you, and the podcast and the Signal group has been a bit of a lifeline, certainly during COVID, and it's a way of me keeping connected with what's happening in good old Blighty, seeing everyone's photos and hearing the chat. Although I do get a bit of anxiety when I wake up in the morning to 250 messages on the thread. And it's like, gosh, when am I going to get through all these? But yes, I've had a great week, actually. I've just come back. I had a weekend in Vancouver where I was at a launch for a tech startup that we help support in the property, prop and fintech world. And Thursday night, I had a great social night. I was talking about music. I was at a get together with Steven Spielberg and John Williams, who were doing a talk on their 50 year and 33 movie collaboration, which was, gosh, it was a very memorable evening, I have to say.
Yes, you sent me that, Gavin. I thought, why on earth is Gavin at a place with John Williams or Steven Spielberg?
Actually, Chris, I have to say, I sent it to the wrong Chris, but I'm glad you did get it. So, yeah, I wasn't gloating.
Well, I'm not entirely sure how to feel about that. but I'll take it. I'll take it anyway. Well, it's really good to have you here, Gavin. I mean, I guess you've been there a couple of 3 years now, haven't you? Say just before COVID, I guess. And
that's right. 2019, January.
Yeah. But you're well used to the sort of tech scene in the UK. You were CIO in various places here, as I remember. And yeah, I mean, all of those places that you worked at, I seem to work with a bit later. And I think, oh yeah, I remember. Gavin was here. You had a lot of different roles here, didn't you?
Sounds like you were there to clean up my mess by this work, Chris.
No, no, no. I can assure you, no, that's not the case.
Did cross a few times, definitely. Yes, I mean, I started my IT career at 18 years old at British Airways, which I think has been topical on the Signal thread over the last few weeks with people having various tech woes.
Yeah, yeah. We'll talk about that in a bit. Yeah. So and so what did you do after that, after BA?
So I did 13 years at BA and I left as head of IT of the UK and I decided to switch gears completely and join the charity sector. And I became the CIO of the Shaw Trust, who are a large disability charity based out of, sort of Wiltshire area, I think was the headquarters then. But I pivoted from there into mainstream recruitment. The Shaw Trust was all about helping disabled and disadvantaged people find work. And it was pretty successful at doing so. But I looked to commercial recruitment as a yardstick for what did best of breed technology look like for helping people find work. And, you know, to my horror, I found that these big organizations were somewhat Neanderthal. They were still getting out of the Rolodex and fax era. And this is around sort of 2007, 2008. So I ended up being IT director for Randstad, who are the world's biggest recruitment agency, operating out of 51 countries now. And I probably stayed in the staffing sector, the recruitment sector, for a good decade after that, ending up at Impellum Group, which is probably a brand you don't know, but people like Blue Arrow and, you know, they're a big 3,500 multi-billion dollar entity with various brands who are best of breed. So Lorien, I guess, will be a brand that a lot of people will know because they're quite big in the tech. And then moved out to this, well, I kind of went into the startup world and got involved with three or four startups back in the UK, a couple of which we exited, and then decided I was going to take some time off, but got given a chance to be CIO of a fast-growing staffing company here in California. And that's what took me to America in 2019.
Fantastic. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about the startup culture in America and things like that, but we're also going to talk about BA, so we should crack on that.
It seems that alongside telecoms companies, utility companies, now transport companies, pretty much top of the list of, oh my God, do I have to use their website organisations as we struggle to be able to make even the simplest things happen. I had a delightful time at the weekend trying to be able to get a ticket on a train and ended up having to do a complex thing, which ended up giving me two tickets because it was £4.80 simpler, cheaper. And you just think, why don't you just make the whole thing simpler? Madness of it all. One of the particular airlines, though, that has found itself in kind of repeating patterns of it not being very good over the last few years, and in fact just before Christmas having a really significant systems outage which meant that they didn't seem to be able to actually fly planes for a bit, is the airline formerly known as British Airways, now BA and part of the conglomerate IAG. And it's one of those service providers where you can almost see all of the joins between all of the legacy archaic systems in the back end that get presented to you as you bounce between what's seemingly an app and then a website and then somewhere in between, and then it forgets who you are and then it gives you the information twice and then forgets all the information. And, you know, that's the kind of general kind of customer journey. I speak actually as my wife, who's flying to Edinburgh tomorrow, found all of her flight bookings just disappeared from the app for a bit, apart from one, which freaked her out immensely until they just suddenly appeared again. It's all great. So as you were saying there, Gav, an organisation you know well and you started your career at, what's going on? I mean, because presumably as well, BA aren't the only one of the, I guess you'd call them legacy airlines that have issues. What's your analysis about why airlines struggle with this stuff?
Well, I can certainly speak to my experience at BA and my knowledge. I still have quite a few friends in both the technology department and in the business, and you can imagine quite senior levels now. Yeah. But you are right, Matt. So I think only the beginning of this year, Southwest, who were often seen as the darling of the regional low-cost industry, they suffered some major outages. In part, that the challenges were weather driven as well. We had a huge cold snap here in America that stranded, you know, several thousands of flights. But their ability to service recover from that was impeded by their lack of tech. But certainly BA, I mean, Matt, if I can start, it's heartbreaking for me personally. You know, I started as a junior programmer in British Airways, and I left as head of IT when I left the airline for the UK, reporting into Paul Kobe, who's was quite a name in the industry, as you might. And at the time, I was immensely proud of what we did at BA. I remember Computer Weekly ran a survey of the top 10 places that people would want to work in the IT industry. And sure, Microsoft, IBM at the time were there, but BA were there at number 6. And we were, you know, we intended to use tech as an offensive weapon to differentiate ourselves versus our competitors. We were first to do things like online check-in, you know, the kiosks that you see at the airports, printing your own boarding pass. And myself and my team were very much at the center of some of those innovations. And I think, you know, tech was very much a weapon for us, as I said. So to see it where it is today, where I share the same experience as you, I go to the website, the UI is clunky. You try doing something and it's not, you know, accepting your details. It's unforgivable in 2023 that a FTSE 100 company have these problems. And I think you've alluded to the issue. When I joined, BA's IT department was 3,000 people out of a total of 56,000. And this was in, you know, the very early 90s. And, you know, that's over 5% of the population. Now, in this digitally disruptive era, you know, having 5% of your population in IT isn't that unusual. Back then, oh, yes, it was. You know, that was a huge amount of people. If BA's IT department were to have been spun off back in 1990, it would have been a FTSE 500 company in its own right, just the IT department in terms of its size and spend. So, yes, I think, you know, reflecting on the tech stack of BA, we had over 500 IT platforms that were running this airline. Every flavor of technology that existed, from Sun Microsystems to DB2 to, you know, big IBM mainframes that I can't remember, we had it all. And I think so much money and time and effort was just trying to keep the lights on of that place. There was very little that I would consider innovation. And I'm going to build up to why I think everything went wrong for BA. You may remember we built an airline called Go, which we eventually sold to EasyJet. And that was the first time that we thought we'd get into the low-cost airline game. And our cost base was hamstrung by, you know, high union costs, wage costs, complexity, lots of different aircraft in terms of fleet. All of these airlines need different parts and different engineering skills and pilots that need to be accredited for them. So we had this enormous cost base. And what we did with Go was have one singular aircraft type, which was a 737. But we decided to start from scratch with IT. And we were able to buy, you know, it was a blank sheet of paper, modern low-cost tech to run an airline in a fairly rudimentary way, but it was a simple airline to run. And I will be very specific about why I think BA, where it all went wrong for BA. BA decided to hire as its CEO a chap called Alex Cruz in 2017. And he was the former CEO of an airline called Vueling, which it was part of IAG, the conglomerate you've referred to. And Vueling was, in a similar way, a low-cost airline. He was a CEO, apparently a very likable chap, great leader. But I think he just made assumptions about tech. His tech knowledge was somewhat limited and thought, well, if Vueling can do this really cheaply with outsourcing and offshoring and lower cost tech, that's what we'll do at BA when he became the airline, the CEO of BA. And I think the pace at which he looked to offshore without doing decent due diligence, you know, there were large scale redundancies of people with many years of knowledge. They knew where the skeletons were buried, was really the beginning of the cause of the problems that they've had over the last 5 years in terms of cyber attacks on the website, vulnerabilities shown to be exposed, fines paid, and major, you know, 24-hour outages. They've been half a dozen of those, you know, almost one a year since 2017. And the operational cost, when I speak to leaders of the business, that huge cost in terms of compensation, reputational damage, service recovering people, it's massively outweighed any saving that they would have made through this attempt to lower their cost base of shifting their IT tech stack and where this work is done.
It's interesting, the kind of dual life that BA tries to live now as well, where it's on the one hand, short haul is effectively a budget airline, although I think maybe quite crucially, still where you can book tickets through the industry systems. So what there's two providers is Sabre and Amadeus.
Yeah.
And that they do the ability for travel agents to be able to do complex bookings where you are bringing up flights from multiple airlines to be able to do things that are complex and clever. And the likes of EasyJet and Ryanair didn't do any of that because it meant they could save a ton of money by only selling direct and not having to do the integrations with these legacy systems. And of course, BA is still doing that and doing it on the one end where people expect it to be a premium service because it's a flag carrier, whatever that means these days.
Yeah.
And also their long haul is trying to compete with the emergent airlines, particularly from the Middle East, who provide exceptionally high quality of service and don't do short haul, are just focused on long haul flights with hubs in places like Dubai and whatever. And that feels like it's also, I mean, those are business challenges, but it's a business challenge that's going to massively impact on their ability to deliver technology because they're neither one thing nor the other, and with all the costs of the expensive version.
Yeah, and this is a really interesting point, Matt. And this was, you know, in our consciousness some 20 years ago when I was there, that BA was all things to all people. And we were having our heels nibbled everywhere from the EasyJets and the Ryanairs of the world on our shortfall, of which we had a huge schedule. I think it was about 1999, there were 24 different airports within the UK and Ireland that we flew to. 24 airports. And you're right, the advent of the low-cost carriers, setting an expectation of what a trip from London to Glasgow could cost, meant that those margins were being squeezed. And then certainly long haul back then, it was Virgin who were really nibbling at our most profitable routes, which were the transatlantic routes to New York, particularly and Florida and LA. And it's good. It's very valid that you mentioned the point about the Middle Eastern carriers. I mean, one thing you might not know is that Qatar Airways effectively own 25% of IAG now. And so, you know, without their money, they've really kept BA afloat in that COVID world.
Well, that was a very interesting run through the woes of British Airways. It's all hope that they can get this sorted at some point, although it seems like they've got a long way to go. But nowadays, Gavin, you've cut your teeth in a few startups here and there, and you went over to Santa Monica to be part of that extremely, isn't it, the beautiful people that you're now part of. Is that right?
Yeah, I stick out like a sore thumb not being a beautiful person. Everyone's the body beautiful here, running along the beach and looking very toned and doing goat yoga and Lord knows what else. But
so when you went to, or when you started working with startups in kind of West Coast America, what did you find you could offer, having the experience you had, that maybe people out there didn't have? And what were the main differences that you found?
Yeah, I think, you know, that there's a tech startup scene out here. So Silicon Beach, I think Matt's been out here a few times, sort of Playa del Rey, as this tech startup scene has moved from Silicon Valley further down the South Coast. So there's a lot of cash out here, quite frankly. There are a lot of angel investors, armchair investors, who are willing to put money into tech startups. You know, it's all been about tech here in California over the last few years. But a lot of the startups, probably they're people who were first jobbers out of, be it Facebook, Google, etc. And they didn't really have, you know, the grey and the experience of enterprise IT. So often these engineers, you know, didn't know how to put a business plan together or an investor deck or really think about monetization. They'll have a half baked idea of an app, often it would be the case, but really not be able to tell a story that made them investable. And ultimately, you know, this is what startups need. They need capital to fund building the team, to market themselves. Often security is something that a lot of tech startup founders don't really think about, you know, in terms of how they build it from the outset. A lot of them didn't have a tech team. They didn't know what was the best tech stack to use to build their particular application. So I've sort of ended up being a bit of an advisor or you know, on the board or my team building out the MVP or indeed the whole product for these tech startups.
Okay, and what would you say, there's a lower bar then in the where you are for funding than in other parts? Oh, or is it just you sure? Well, because I'm thinking they're also probably a lot more, you know, everybody wants to be in a startup. So many people in the various tech companies wanting, you know, got their big idea. It's a bit like going to Hollywood and wanting to be an actor, right? There are a lot of opportunities, but there are probably more people as well. But you still think it's a lower bar?
So there's definitely a lower bar with getting that first and second round of investment. I mean, I think I mentioned earlier, I was in Vancouver over the weekend, and it was for a tech startup that's been running for 5 years, and they've only just launched their product. So they've never made a penny.
No revenue.
They've literally just launched. It's in fintech and property tech. And I can tell you, they've been valued at $25 million, and they've already raised $3 million of funding. And, you know, I'm not going to mention the name of the company, but, you know, let's just say there are some question marks about the quality of the product that they're about to launch, which is in the, like I said, the fintech and proptech market. But that's hopefully an idea of just the amount of dry powder, as we call it, the amount of money that people are willing to part with. Because I think over the last 2-3 years, you know, a lot of there's so many wealthy people out here. I cannot, you know, tell you it's so much more different. And the due diligence that these armchair investors do is borderline negligible. That your typical armchair investor, angel investor out here, will probably make 10 investments a year. You know, depending on the size of their wallet, they could be around $100,000 each. And you know, their expectation is that 7 out of 10 will fail. One might give a 5x return, but they're hoping that one's going to, you know, land the jackpot and give them a 100x return. And that is typically the profile of an angel investor that we would work with and come across out here.
Is there too much money? I mean, has it got to a point where you've got just like so many daft ideas that you can't see wood for trees?
So I'd certainly say that, you know, with what's happened with the economy in the last half of last year, I think there's a bit more due diligence that's happening. But I will explain, there's actually more money probably coming into that early stage round than there was before. Because what you're seeing are VCs who are not about to spend $300 million on a Series C or Series D, a later stage investment. So what they're doing is they're going into, because a lot of these companies are now seen as overvalued. I mean, are we allowed to mention names of companies on here?
Yeah.
So I mean, a good example, you know, so Wakato, who I think you'll know as an organization, or, you know, they're a middleware company. No, you're shaking heads, no? They're like an iPaaS company. Well, they have a revenue of $50 million, and they basically got a valuation. They got a Series E valuation, which took them to $7 billion valuation. Now, that's a 93 times multiple on revenue, which is huge. Now, by contrast, the Access Group in the UK, who are the UK's biggest software company, they've just had a $9 billion valuation on $400 million EBIT, you know, that, and that's good recurring revenue. So, you know, the valuations that are being given to startup and companies that aren't even turning a profit out here, up until H2 last year, were eye watering and unrealistic. It was a bit like the dot-com boom. People just had money, which, you know, lots of wealthy people made money during the times of COVID. There were lots of stimulus checks being handed by the government. And I think the net wealth of that top 1%, you know, pretty much doubled during COVID. And with concerns about crypto, you know, and that people had seen capital asset gains with their property, tech startups were a very tax efficient way of moving some of this capital.
I remember reading a book which, the name escapes me because I'm of that age, but it was written by a former Newsweek journalist. Dan Lyons, thank you. And he was made redundant from Newsweek after being a journalist for Newsweek for most of his career, or a large portion of his career, and being a journalist, print journalist, for all of his career. So he decided he would go into the world of startup, and he went to work for HubSpot, I think it was.
Correct.
And just the slightly jaundiced view of somebody in their early 50s, heaven forbid that somebody in their early 50s should have a jaundiced view of the world, and they but just sort of unpacking what was going on and how, you know, the first thing is that to a great extent, tech startups are an asset class. And their only reason to exist is to be able to try to be able to make a return on their investment. It doesn't matter what they actually do with the technology. Technology is almost ancillary to the real business, which is being able to take some investment money and be able to multiply it.
Yeah.
And the way in which the technology that is built will more often than not be extremely, extremely shoddy. And it's an exercise in just holding it all together until you get the exit, which is usually either maybe an IPO or acquisition by a much bigger company, which means that you can then just relax. And if it sort of slightly falls apart after you've managed to get the money, then it's all fine. And it completely changed my view about exactly how all of this stuff works. And, you know, out of it, some great stuff happens. But it's almost, it's an incredibly, strikes me as being an incredibly inefficient way to innovation. It's literally throwing, you know, money at a wall.
Yeah, it's interesting you saying inefficient. I think one of the things that I feel that is a bit more progressive out here versus the startup community that I was exposed to in the UK, because I started my startup life actually in the UK and we were involved in three or four startups there, is that I think because there is that amount of cash, there is so much more opportunity for people to, dare I say, make mistakes along the way and get second chances and be supported. So as well as the cash, I think there's a huge network of investors who will try and add value above and beyond cash to optimize the likelihood of some success. But by the same token, I don't want to, you know, take away from the fact that there are some really daft ideas that I've seen out here that have got funding. But, you know, hopefully with the correction in the market of late last year, we'll be a bit more sensible in terms of valuations, the amount of money that's being thrown at things, and the rigor that some of these investors will make in terms of before they part with cash. Mm.
What are the things at the moment you're hearing as being the trump cards, as it were, being played in pitches by startups? So you get, you know, waves of either types of technology that they say they will be using that will make it easier for people to invest, or analogies that they will draw with existing businesses. So, you know, the AI-enabled Facebook for hamsters would be an example of both the technology of you know, the current fad technology and the metaphor that tells you where the whole, you know, the whole proposition sits. Are there any ones in particular at the moment that you're hearing that you find particularly interesting?
So what was definitely massive last year in 2022 was if you said that you were involved in Web 3.0, you know, the metaverse or NFTs in particular, it attracted funding. People, you know, just wanted to be part of that bandwagon. And I think Chris was quite articulate in a recent one of your WB44 podcasts where I think we're a bit more circumspect about, you know, the metaverse and, you know, the utility and commercialization of it. And you know, we I think we all still believe there's something for blockchain, but, you know, is crypto really all it's hyped up to be? So I think that's where we were just seeing funding come flooding in. There was a company, a startup we were helping in Singapore, and it was basically a platform to allow children to become entrepreneurs where they could mint their own NFTs. They could basically do their own artwork and this had funding, you know, because of the thinking about kids and entrepreneurship. But they deliberately threw in, you know, blockchain in their pitch deck and these were words that were must-haves in your investor deck. And then the second thing you said, what are the, I forgot what your what
sort
what
of metaphors though.
Yeah, the other thing that really helps is if you had a name on your advisory board. So if you dragged some kid who did 3 years at Google or Meta or Nvidia or Netflix, you know, we're advised that on the investor panel you show advisors and you show the brands where they've worked, and that somehow lulls people into a full sense of security that, okay, it's not a couple of kids, they've actually got people have worked for a FANG company that kind of know what they're doing. And, you know, with what's going on here in Silicon Valley at the moment, with on average, you know, 10% of jobs being shed from these big companies, there'll be a lot of these people that will be available. I come across so many people at conferences. You mentioned HubSpot. I bumped into someone at a conference in San Francisco last year, and I think he was in the top 30 people that worked in HubSpot, the first 30 people that worked in HubSpot. Wasn't particular senior, but let's just say I think all of us collectively wouldn't have his, you know, there are a lot of rich people that were just in the right place at the right time, who through stock options have made a ton of money, who are now themselves investing. They're sitting on so much cash. They're the ones cutting the checks to other startups.
Mm. And what about automation, Gavin? That's something that you've been working on for a while, and it's almost become it's one of those technologies which has matured, really, in terms of the expectation and understanding or awareness in enterprise, right? So there is space now for organizations to do the automation piece, or the pitch and automation piece, and Microsoft, of course, are suddenly coming up on the rails with a lot of their technology. And that, so what's your take on that in terms of what you're doing and where you see that going in the next 18 months or so?
Yeah, it's something I feel quite strongly about. I was CEO of an RPA, first generation RPA company that was predominantly based out of India, and we ultimately sold it to one of our biggest customers, which is the UK's largest private law enforcement company. And I'm very proud of it because, in fact, they won the award this year at the UK's IT Awards for best automation, beating UiPath, Blue Prism, and various big government projects. And I think my take on it is it's still maturing. I feel that it's a technology that's had it's the quickest return on value. You can put in an RPA bot quite quickly within weeks and see the ROI. And it's, I think you alluded to it last week, that it's things that you're seeing shadow IT or end users start mobilizing with things like Power. But I feel that it's still somewhat immature. That some of the big players, I feel that their licensing, you need a PhD to get your head around it, between, you know, the platform fees, the runtime fees, and, you know, they're looking to monetize it. UiPath, after so many years, only this year are likely to break even. You know, and they've seen their valuation from the time they floated, I think, drop by, gosh, about 80%. You know, I think at the time they were a 40, 50 billion valuation, and they're now single digits. But I think there's a lot of scrutiny over these, the big three, in terms of bot fragility, that, you know, the UI changes or the environment changes where the bot's working, these bots just crash. And you're starting to see this next generation of ancillary tools to support the RPA world, where you've got these bot orchestrators or tooling that really checks for the environment and warns the humans when the bots are likely to break. So I think it's one of these technologies that have been, you know, deployed without a huge amount of thought, and we're now learning about the idea of centers of excellence for things like automation. But I was listening to your last week's podcast on the plane, and I was like nodding vociferously when I felt that when you talked about tactical automation, it'll be massive this year. It will give companies the fastest return on value in a world where, you know, here in America, there are 11 million unfilled jobs, and I think it's over a million in the UK. You know, we cannot find workers. And obviously we have wage inflation because of the underlying normal inflation. So I think this will accelerate companies looking at intelligent automation to remove that mundane work that humans do. And certainly it's something that with my customers and companies I've worked with, you know, we're finding it very easy to take out that 25%, that bottom 25% of people's jobs, because invariably those office jobs, those operational jobs, are going into platforms, doing data entry, making decisions within multiple platforms. And yeah, we're now at the stage where we've got intelligent automation that links to deep learning models. So we've got bots that can think and learn, And I think this is going, well, it's going to be, according to Gartner, you know, the biggest growth area in terms of enterprise computing over the next 3 years.
Are you seeing the governance frameworks for this emerging alongside the clever tools? Because the one thing that strikes me from the generations of experience that we've had with low code and no code, and I'm thinking particularly of Bless It Excel, which is kind of the original low-code platform, that without having good, robust governance and control in place, this stuff goes from quickly saving costs to generating massive costs.
Yeah, I think it's the governance has skyrocketed to the number one agenda item in this tech. I think the tech's not hit a plateau, but you're right. I think as an industry, the intelligent automation industry risk reputational damage unless they're the ones really leading the charge with companies to say to put in good governance, because it's the brands like UiPath who are getting the bad name rather than the lack of diligence that an end company is doing. There's actually a massive, it's an operational excellence conference in Miami in 2 weeks' time, and literally a third of the agenda is all about, and it's mostly RPA companies, the big ones there, but a third of the entire track is all about governance and setting up your center of excellence and again, you know, minimizing the risk of bot failures. Because as you take people out of your organization and you rely on these bots to do these jobs at 5 times the speed and at 16 times the scale and 24 hours a day, you know, if this bot goes down, you have no plan B in theory, because you've taken out all the people. So it's imperative that governance is there, disaster recovery is thought through, and yes, good governance. And like you said, there's tooling that's emerging in the market that really gives organizations that dashboard to ensure the health of their bots.
I think it's going to be interesting to see to the extent to which, and particularly if we are going into recession, which appears fairly likely, the opportunity to automate low-value processes set against the opportunity to remove low-value processes. And I do see a world where we end up, and this is something we've been talking about a bit with kind of the emergence of some of these new AI tools, that rather than getting rid of daft paper forms, what we'll have is a bot filling in the daft paper form that has been made digital and a bot reading the daft paper form that has now been made digital to be able to stick the same stupid information into the same database table that nobody ever then looks at again. And it's interesting how much people will be focused on actually streamlining rather than just automating.
Matt, you're absolutely right. My experience, and I've been in this space for probably the last 6 years, it's all too easy for an IT department to apply their magic wand to an outmoded process. But you get little friction because in a way there's no change. There's no business change. And the moment an IT department has to sit down with a department and really scrutinize and pull up the can of worms of why are we even doing this in the first place? I think it's just a harder journey for IT departments. And when I say IT departments that are owning technology, you know, for RPA departments, every what's the saying? Every problem is a nail, you know, or whatever.
If the only tool you have is a hammer, then every problem is a nail.
Thank you. So, yes, that's definitely something I've witnessed a lot over the last half decade.
Well, that brings us to the end of another show. I haven't been automated out of this job yet. But to be fair, I don't get paid either, which is why probably nobody's bothered to automate it. Gav, the week ahead, what excitement beckons for you on the west coast of the United States of America?
Well, I won't be on the west coast. I'll be flying to Houston, where helping an organization who are all about hiring nurses from 51 developing countries into America. In fact, it's the fastest growing industry in the US right now is nursing. Every year, 91,000 nurses leave the system in America, and the average age of a nurse is 56 and a half years. So I'm helping this organization with some great tech to help bring nurses from other shores here.
That's fascinating. And it's, I guess, if you look at the current crisis in healthcare in the UK, something of a worry that the biggest country in the world is trying to be able to import nurses, because there's that skills gap is definitely here as well.
Yeah, I'm well aware of obviously what I hear going on in the NHS, and it's going to be a tough one for the UK, I have to say, because you're competing against the US, where the salaries are, you know, very different to what the NHS pay. During COVID, we were working with nurses who were earning $250,000 a year as travel nurses here. Dollars, obviously. Wow.
Yeah. But even so, wow.
Yeah.
Chris, how's your week ahead looking?
I've got a really interesting yet manic week ahead. Tomorrow is Tuesday, as we were, so I'm in the office on tomorrow. I'm going to see an old colleague and have a quick coffee with an old colleague. Then I am going to, on Wednesday, we've got a board meeting. Then I'm going to go and talk to a local company who they're having a bit of an IT offsite. I'm going to do a bit of digital transformation, kind of state of the nation stuff for them. And then I'm going to down to London, and I'm going to the New Freeman's Dinner for the Worshipful Company of Information Technologists, which is always the highlight of the year. It's the best dinner of the year for sure. Then I'm going to catch up with somebody else down in London the next morning, and then I'm coming home. And then actually on Friday I'm going back down to London again, because on Saturday I'm doing GovCamp, which I've never done before, not being a government waller, so I'm doing GovCamp on Saturday, so I'm looking forward to that too. So yeah, really busy one.
Wow, that's quite something. I'm going to be barely leaving my house, because my other half is off to Edinburgh for work and then to Prague to see some friends, so I'm going to be mostly working from the home office. But we've got actually an on-site for, I think there's about 45 people from various parts of our organisation gathering together near Waterloo on Wednesday. So I'm looking forward to seeing some of my colleagues en masse in person, which should be good. And I am also working on some exercises to be able to get people thinking about how they can make better use of their social capital, thinking about networking, but by giving people some interesting examples to play around with and thinking about who they would talk to. So we're going to see how that lands within the organisation to help people get to think more about how they're building relationships and the importance of their relationships. So that should be fun. So there we go. We come to the end of yet another wonderful edition, 249th. I seriously had not realised that there was some sort of decimal landmark coming up next week. So I'm thoroughly looking forward to 250th. We'll have another guest. We will have more conversation. So until then, Gav, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we will be back next week, same place as ever.
Thank you for listening to WB40. You can find us on the internet at wb40podcast.com, on Twitter at wb40podcast, and on all good podcasting platforms.